I studied the book of Ecclesiastes. Ecclesiastes is one of the most fascinating books in all of the Word of God. Sometimes people feel that it's puzzling. Others feel that it's melancholy. In fact, one fellow told me the other day that it depressed him to read the book of Ecclesiastes. But it doesn't depress me. It's inspiring to me to read the words of this wise man. Solomon, without doubt, is the author of the book. He was the most famous and influential man of his time. His wisdom and his literary achievements are unequal. But the book doesn't name him by name, but it describes him, I think, in words that are beyond discussion. Ecclesiastes 1 and 1, he says, the words of the preacher, the son of David, king in Jerusalem. Of course, Solomon was the son of David, and he was a king in Jerusalem. But I think the clincher is found in verse 12 when he said, I, the preacher, was king over Israel in Jerusalem. This has to refer unto Solomon because he was the only son of David who was the king over Israel in Jerusalem. Now his son, Rehoboam, who could have been called the son of David, who actually was a grandson, ruled over Judah in the city of Jerusalem, but not over Israel. So it had to be Solomon. There are other passages that suggest this by description, such as Ecclesiastes 1 and 16, 2 and 9, 12 and 9, of course, talking about the wonders of this man. I think that Solomon's personal history best fits the book. His great wealth, his great wisdom, his building projects, all of these fill the bill for the profile of the author. He was a man that was blessed above any other man of his time. And a while ago, Glenn read some of this from another translation. I'll read it to you from the King James. In 1 Kings 4 and 29, and God gave Solomon wisdom and understanding exceeding much, and largeness of heart, even as the sand that is on the seashore. And Solomon's wisdom exceeded the wisdom of all the children of the east country, and all the wisdom of Egypt, for he was wiser than all men. And he spake 3,000 proverbs, and his songs were 1,005. There came of the people to hear the wisdom of Solomon from all the kings of the earth, which had heard of his wisdom. 1 Kings 10 and 14, now the weight of gold that came to Solomon in 1 year was 666 talents of gold. Moreover, the king made a great throne of ivory and overlaid it with the best gold. And all King Solomon's drinking vessels were gold. So King Solomon exceeded all the kings of the earth for riches and for wisdom. And all the earth sought to Solomon to hear his wisdom, which God had put in his heart. And the king made silver in Jerusalem as stones. This tells us something about his wealth, something about his wisdom. You know, in verse 14 it says that he had as a yearly income 660 talents, or 666 talents of gold. That's more than 4 tons, I'm told. According to present day values, it'd be about $40 million in value, according to today's values. The time of the writing, assuming that Solomon is the author of the book, we say it's somewhere between 945 and 930. Now, he served as the king of Israel from 970 to 930. We believe that Solomon wrote this book toward the end of his career and the end of his life. The purpose of the book is suggested in at least two passages. In Ecclesiastes 1 and 3, what profit hath a man of all his labor which he taketh under the sun? And chapter 2 and verse 3, I sought in mine heart to see what was that good for the sons of men which they should do under the heaven all the days of their life. And so we might put the purpose of the book in the form of a question. What is the chief good or goal or purpose of life? Solomon explored this theme through reasoning, through observation, through experience, and so forth. Throughout the book of Ecclesiastes, Solomon affirms that all earthly life is vanity, it's empty, it's futile. And his experiences, of course, prove this. And the book is a dramatic, we might say, autobiography of his experiences and his reflections as he searched for meaning in life. The general thesis might be set forth like this. Solomon, the king of Israel, proclaims that life viewed from the earthly perspective is brief, empty, and meaningless. Ecclesiastes 1 and 14, he said, I've seen all the works that are done under the sun. Behold, all is vanity and vexation of spirit. Chapter 2 and verse 11, then I looked on all the works that my hands had wrought, and on the labor that I had labored to do, and behold, all was vanity and vexation of spirit, and there was no profit under the sun. And so the book is teaching us, I believe, our right relationship to this old earth life. It takes us away from the love and the interest of this world to God. It shows us the vanity, the emptiness, the uselessness of all of the things that are solely looked at from a human or an earthly perspective. Solomon couldn't find happiness. He couldn't find meaning in a worldly and sensuous life. He saw the earthly life at its very best. He had everything that a man could possibly desire. And so he tried to find happiness in a materialistic philosophy, and it was all empty. He turned to the pleasures of building, gardening, cattle breeding, art collecting, and music. He tried wealth, the enjoyment of a reputation. He found all of these vain and empty. He also tried every kind of evil pleasure, such as sexual immorality. All was vanity and vexation of spirit, and that literally means of feeding on wind. Now, you don't get much profit from feeding on wind. Maybe a burp is about all that you might get. I don't think that this is a book that we need to ignore, because in our materialistic society, there's a great need for us to understand the message of Solomon. And our youth-oriented society is of special value, because it seems that Solomon is turning his attention especially to the young. It tells us that in the book there are goads and there are males, and that's very interesting to me. In chapter 12, verse 11, the words of the wise are as goads, and as nails fastened by the masters of assemblies, which are given from one shepherd. And we know that a goad is a sharp stick used to prod a lazy or reluctant animal and get him to move. Well, of course, he's saying that the words of the wise man are designed to goad us or to prod our thinking. Then he said the words of the preachers, literally the masters of the assemblies, are given to nail or to anchor our lives. And all of this, of course, I think is found in the book of Ecclesiastes. It's a book that prods our thinking, that gives us exhortations, that provide stability and direction for our lives. Now, Ecclesiastes, as probably has already been noted, belongs to the wisdom poetic literature. The Bible contains several different kinds of literature, as has already been noted, and the different kinds of literature serve different didactic purposes or functions. Wisdom poetic literature is practical direction for obtaining wholeness out of the brokenness of natural life. I think that's true in Job, Psalms, Song of Solomon, and also Proverbs and Ecclesiastes. But Ecclesiastes just simply affirms that meaning for life is not in life, but rather in the one who gives life. You know, there are three classes of teachers in ancient times. They're all mentioned for us in Jeremiah 18 and 18. For the law shall not perish from the priest, nor counsel from the wise, nor the word from the prophet. The prophet, of course, was a spokesman for God. He spoke for God unto man. The priest was the one that taught the law and, of course, maintained worship in the temple. But the wise men were those that gave counsel and advice about life. Theirs was a practical wisdom concerning a godly life. Their wisdom was a gift from God. It didn't come from books. It didn't come from schools. It was given to them by God, as it was to Solomon in 1 Kings 3, 10 through 12. And of course, Solomon was the wisest of all of the wise men. The prophet spoke from a point of view of divine revelation. The wise men spoke from the point of view of experience and observation. But I want to hasten to say that when they wrote down their observation, their experiences, it was a true record, because that's the way that God would have it be. If we were to give a title to the book of Ecclesiastes, we'd say it's the preacher's search for meaning. In verse 1, I think we can see a beginning of the introduction to the book. In fact, verses 1 through 3. The words of the preacher, the son of David, king in Jerusalem. Solomon calls himself the preacher, Koheleth. which literally means the preacher. The Septuagint translates it Ecclesiastes. And of course, this is how we get the name of the book, the preacher or the public speaker. So the writer of the book of Ecclesiastes was a public speaker, and evidently he was a very good one. Somebody has suggested that what is written here is simply a lecture that was delivered by Solomon, and God wanted it to be preserved for all future generations. Now, according to 1 Kings 11, 1 through 13, we learn that Solomon became alienated from God. Verse 4 said, "For it came to pass when Solomon was old, that his wives turned away his heart after other gods, and his heart was not perfect for the Lord his God, as was the heart of David his father." Some of the preliminary conclusions that he reaches in the books evidently is taken from this time, or the experiences of his life when he was alienated from God. But you know, that's the reason that I believe that the book was written during the end of his, toward the end of his life. Because evidently, according to chapter 12, he repented before his death. In verse 2, "Vanity of vanities, saith the preacher, vanity of vanities, all is vanity." The word vanity is found 37 times in the book of Ecclesiastes. And it means emptiness, something transitory, unsatisfactory. This, of course, is one of the themes and purposes of the book of Ecclesiastes. And that is that the vanity of all earthly things. Thank you. The book shows the disillusion and the disappointment and what this old world has to offer. Now, in verse 3, he gives us the question that he was trying to answer all through the book. "What profit hath a man of all his labor which he taketh under the sun?" In other words, is there any value, is there any profit in all of the things of this earth? Notice this little phrase, "under the sun." That's a very important phrase, and you find it about 25 times in the book of Ecclesiastes. And it's important to the understanding of the message. It seems to me that this dissertation of the preacher is looking at things from an earthly standpoint. And that's the reason that we can say it's all vanity, vanity of vanities, saith the preacher. In chapter 1, we see how the preacher began his search for meaning in life. In verses 4 through 11, he saw the futility of all the cycles of nature and life. He saw a world that was a general routine and an unending monotony. Verse 4, he said, "One generation passeth away, and another generation cometh, but the earth abideth forever." He's observing the transitory nature of man's life. He's living today, tomorrow is quickly replaced. And the point I think that Solomon is making is simply the fact that although man is God's noble creature, he is going to soon pass, but the old crude materials of the earth are going to continue on. Verse 5, "The sun also ariseth, and the sun goeth down, and hasteth to his place where he arose." Verse 9, "There is no new thing under the sun." What was Solomon's point? It is the fact that nothing seems to change. Then in verse 8, "All things are full of labor. Man cannot utter it. The eye is not satisfied with seeing, or the ear filled with hearing." His point, nothing seems to satisfy. Then Solomon began his search for meaning by using human wisdom in chapter 1, verses 12 through 18. You remember that God gave him a special wisdom from heaven, and he used that wisdom to examine human wisdom. And he came to the conclusion that if a man tries to find the answers to life purely based upon human wisdom, it's going to be a grasping after wind. Now, I don't think that this is an indictment of all wisdom, because the Bible tells us about a God-given wisdom that we're to seek for and that we're to pray for. But it is an indictment against human wisdom. The best definition that I've found of that is this: a wisdom that seeks to understand life but leaves God out of the picture. That is human wisdom. Such wisdom as that is vexation of spirit or feeding upon wind. In the second chapter, we read of his efforts to explore the virtue of mirth, pleasure, wine, folly, the acquisition of wealth, and great accomplishments. Verse 3, he said, "I sought in my heart to give myself unto wine yet acquainted my heart with wisdom to lay hold on folly, till I might see what is that good for the sons of men, which they should do under the heaven all the days of their life. He said in verses 4 through 6, he made many things. I made me great works. I built me houses. I planted me vineyards. I made me gardens and orchards, and I planted trees in them of all kinds of fruits. I made me pools of water to water therewith the wood that bringeth forth trees. He also acquired whatever his heart desired, such as servants, livestock, silver, gold, treasures, singers, and what he called the delights of the sons of men. The New American Standard Version says, and the pleasures of men, many concubines. And of course, we read in 1 Kings 11, 1 through 3, he had 700 wives and 300 concubines. Now, none of this brought him happiness, because he said in Ecclesiastes 2 and 17, therefore I hated life, because the work that is wrought under the sun is grievous unto me, for all is vanity and vexation of spirit. But even though he had tried life, he found it vain and he hated it, yet he accepted it. And in verse 24, he said, there is nothing better for man that he should eat and drink and that he should make his soul enjoy good in his labor. This also I saw, that it was from the hand of God. Now that's a conclusion that he'll reach six times in this book. Now he's not saying the old fatalistic view, eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow you'll die. But what he is saying, enjoy life where you find it. Take life as you find it and enjoy it as a gift from God. And he lets us know that this ability to enjoy one's labor is from God. It was from the hand of God, he said here. So I don't think that any person can truly enjoy life without God. You see, this is the first time that the preacher mentions God in all of this. He sought to find happiness and meaning and satisfaction in life in all of these different areas, wisdom, folly, madness, wealth, and he found it. He found nothing under the sun that was really fulfilling. But now then, with God giving him wisdom and knowledge and joy, then he can enjoy the good of his labor. Now he finds real purpose and meaning for his life. This, of course, shows the dependence that we have upon God for our real enjoyment in life. Now in chapters 1 and 2, Solomon is basing his conclusions on experience. In chapters 3 through 6, he'll base his conclusions upon observation. Let us notice some of those observations. One is that all things serve God's purpose, which man can't always understand. Ecclesiastes 3, 1 through 8, you've read it many times. To everything there's a season, a time. To every purpose under the heaven, a time to be born, a time to die, and so forth. He illustrates, as it were, the constant changing cycles of life by 14 common examples of life. Now, he's not commending these, nor is he condemning these. But he's just simply saying to us that one day we have a positive act that is going to be balanced by a negative act the next day. And he said this is just all a part of God's inexplicable purpose. Another thing that he saw was the injustice and the oppression of men. In chapter 3 and verse 16, he talked about the injustice in the courts of justice. Chapter 4 and verse 1, the oppression upon men. But he also lets us know that God allows injustice to test the character of men. Chapter 3, verse 18 through 21. He saw the vanity of skillful and selfish work, because he said it just breeds envy, chapter 4 and verse 4. He saw the vanity of being alone in the midst of all of this. Two are better than one. He saw the vanity of popularity, even of a king upon his throne, chapter 4, 14 through 16. In chapter 5, he saw the importance of proper worship. He said, keep thy foot when thou goest to the house of God. Be more ready to hear than to give the sacrifice of foods, for they consider not that they do evil. Conduct yourself very carefully when you go to the house of God. Listen closely and worship correctly. Don't offer to God the sacrifice of foods. He also said you're not to be rash in your vows or your promises or your commitments that you make to God. Verses 2 and 3. He offered a caution regarding riches. Riches, he said, are vanity because they won't satisfy. That's found in Ecclesiastes 5, 10, and 12. Then he warns about riches that are hoarded or kept to one's own hurt. If we hoard up for our own selfish reasons our money, he said it can be to your hurt. So Solomon's wisdom is we're to live a simple life. We're to work hard and enjoy the fruit of our labor as a gift from God. And chapter 7, we find a counsel for better living. And you'll find in the first 14 verses the word better time and again. A good name is better than precious ointment, and a day of death than the day of one's birth. In other words, honor is better than luxury. One's death day is better than his birthday. He goes on to say that a funeral is better than a party. Rebuke of the wise is better than the song of fools. The end is better than the beginning. Patience is better than pride. The present is better than the past. Wisdom is better than wealth. Resignation is better than indignation. The latter part of the chapter, he gives us counsel for balanced living. Seems to me that the preacher is saying we should be counseled against extremism. Don't go to excess. The Greeks had a motto, nothing in excess. Aristotle said that virtue is the fine art of holding the middle between extremes. That was taught by Solomon 3,000 years ago. For instance, verse 16, be not righteous overmuch. There is a righteousness, my friends, that is to be avoided. It's born of pride. It's born of arrogance. That's the kind of righteousness that the Pharisees had. That's the kind of righteousness that a person has when he thinks he's got to go off to some secluded space so that he can live the righteous life. That's being righteous overmuch. But then he says, be not overmuch wicked. Does that mean a little wickedness is okay? No. But he's saying that you are imperfect creatures, and he says that in this context. And you're going to make mistakes from time to time. But just because you make mistakes, don't just give it all up and give in to a life of sin. I think that's taught by the apostle in Romans 3:23 and Romans 6:1-2. Then he says, don't believe or pay attention to everything that people say. Chapter 7, verse 21-22. Don't be overly sensitive to what folks say to you or about you. In chapter 8 and 9, we have wisdom to endure life's vanities, enduring the governments of the land. He said, submit to the authorities that be. And then enduring the inevitable prospect of death in the latter part of the chapter. Death happens to everybody, he says. It happens both to the righteous and to the wicked. And he said, when you die, you're not going to know anything that is going on here in this world. If you want to discuss that later, we can. Then in chapters 10 and 11, we find more wisdom in enduring life's vanities. He tells us about the harm of folly. Folly mars a person's fine reputation. He says folly often manifests itself in the governments of men. In chapter 11, it talks about the value of benevolence. Verses 1 and 2, we have parallel verses encouraging kindness and hospitality. Cast thy bread upon the water, and thou shalt find it after many days. Give a portion to seven and also to eight, for thou knowest not what evil shall be upon the earth. Do your benevolence without expecting anything in return. When you cast your bread on the water, you don't expect to see it again. But in God's economy, you see, he says, thou shalt find it not many days, hence you'll be blessed. Now, in chapter 11, verse 9, through the end of the book, I believe we find what we might call the conclusion of the whole matter. It seems to me that Solomon wrote all of it that he wrote, telling us about all of his experiments of life, so that he might write this, because this reveals the results of all of his experience. He said, rejoice in your youth. Chapter 11, verse 9, rejoice, O young man, in thy youth, and let thy heart cheer thee in the days of thy youth, and walk in the ways of thine heart and the sight of thine eyes. But know thou that for all of these things God will bring you into judgment. Young people, is God a killjoy? No. God expects you to enjoy life. He's created you with the ability to enjoy life. But he goes on to say, don't lose sight of the judgment. You enjoy life. Enjoy it to the fullest, to the maximum. But he says, know thou that God will bring you into judgment. So you need to be selective in what you do to have fun. In the next verse, he gives us a parallelism. Therefore, remove sorrow from thy heart and put away evil from thy flesh, for childhood and youth are vanity. Scholars say this is a parallelism because you remove sorrow from the heart as you put away evil from your life. I think that youth, of course, is a very special time in life, and it can be a wonderful time. But the key is to heed the very next admonition. In chapter 12, verse 1, remember thy Creator in the days of thy youth, while the evil days come not, nor the years draw nigh, when thou shalt say, I have no pleasure in them. What's the whole result of his experiments? He said, begin right. Remember now, this time, your Creator in the days of your youth. And he's talking about evil days of old age. And he describes them further in verse 2, while the sun or the light or the moon or stars be not darkened, nor the clouds return after the rain. Remember your Lord in the springtime of life, in the prime and prosperity of your life, while you've got the world by the tail in a downhill pool, while the clouds are not returning after the rain. The problems are solved and they come again and again. Remember him now. Remember him in a time when age and death, before age and death catches up with us. He uses various figures to show the process of growing old. Then he gives that beautiful language describing death in verse 6 and 7. Wherever the silver cord be loosed, or the golden bowl be broken, or the pitcher broken at the fountain, or the wheel broken at the cistern, then shall the dust return to the earth as it was, and the spirit shall return unto God who gave it. Seems to me that the language here compares life to a golden lamp bowl that is held by a silver cord. The cord breaks, the bowl breaks, all the light-emitting fluid is spills. And of course, light is equivalent to life many times. Then he compares it to a pitcher of water that is broken, and all of that life-giving fluid runs out. Then the last is of a wheel or a windlass that you use to bring the water up out of the well. He said it collapses, and of course you have no access unto life. Then he says, this old body that is made of dust goes back to the dust. And the spirit, though, he says, goes unto God who gave it. Now it seems to me that he restates his theme in verse 8. Vanity of vanity, saith the preacher, all is vanity. That seems to be his signature statement throughout the book. And we could talk a long time about the many vanities. But always remember this, and I think this is key to understanding the book of Ecclesiastes. This theme must be remembered in the context. He's talking about the vanity of life under the sun. He's talking about the vanity of life lived only from an earthly perspective. Now, verses 9 through 10, he gives us the epilogue. And moreover, because the preacher was wise, he still taught the people knowledge. Yea, he gave good heed and sought out and set in order many proverbs. The preacher sought to find out acceptable words. That which was written was upright, even words of truth. The words of the wise were as goads and nails fastened by the masters of assemblies, which were given from one shepherd. And further by these, my son, he admonished, of making of many books there is no end, but study is a weariness of the flesh. The preacher is going to go on with his work, teaching others God's word, teaching others knowledge, and seeking for knowledge and for truth and for righteousness. But he says, young people, remember that there is no end to the books that are written. And all of your reading of those books will never find life's answers. Then he gives us the grand conclusion in verse 13 and 14. Let us hear the conclusion of the whole matter. Fear God and keep his commandments, for this is the whole duty of man. For God shall bring every work into judgment with every secret thing, whether it be good or whether it be evil. Now, this is Solomon's conclusion after a long, painful, and disappointing search for meaning in life, for purpose in life, for happiness in life, without God. And he says that he didn't find it under the sun. He didn't find it from a purely earthly perspective. And so he's driven back to the teachings of his old father, wasn't he? And of course, that was David's teaching, that they should fear God, they should keep his commandments. Seems to me in this, he just throws down the gauntlet, as it were, and he raises the white flag, and he surrenders to the leadership and the power of Almighty God. Fear God, keep his commandments. This is the whole duty of man. That is, revere God, live in awe of him, live in dread of displeasing God. Obey his commandments, do whatever he says. He said, this is the whole duty of man. The word duty is not in the original. It's in italics in the King James. So it could be translated, this is the whole of man. This is man's all, as it says in the New King James. So if you want to be a whole person, fear God, keep his commandments, for this is the whole of man. This is his whole meaning for life. And finally, the basis for his conclusion, for God shall bring every work into judgment with every secret thing, whether it be good or whether it be evil. What a fine climax to this great book. In view of the fact that one of these days we're going to have to stand before the Lord in judgment, who knows even the secrets of our heart, who knows every work that we perform, he says, you fear God, you keep his commandments, for this is the whole reason for your being here in this world. This is the whole key to real happiness.